Well, what time is it? Are we like the children of Issachar who understand the times and know what God's people should do?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is one of my goals here on The Line of Fire to be a son of Issachar in the spirit of 1 Chronicles 12:32, understanding the times and knowing what Israel, or in this case, knowing what God's people should do. What time is it? How should we be responding? This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. We serve here on the air 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, as your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society and chaos in a church all too often in compromise. And I want to talk about what time it is. I want to get your feedback as well. And I want to open the word in this regard, as well as comment on a number of things happening in the news today. Before I explain about the children of Issachar and understanding the times, did anybody think that in the year 2016, we'd be reading headlines like this from the Washington Times? A university, speaking of California State University, Los Angeles, so Cal State, LA, the university is offering segregated housing to shield black students from, quote, microaggressions. School officials have honored requests by CSLA's Black Student Union and will offer, quote, housing space delegated for black students at the Halisi Scholars Black Living Learning Community. They are going to offer segregated housing to protect the students from, quote, microaggressions. Anybody expect to hear something like that in the year 2016? That we would be going back to segregation to protect black Americans or other blacks in America from, quote, microaggressions? So that would be saying something that could be perceived as offensive. I'm all for being honoring and respectful. That's not my issue here. My issue is the absurdity of where things are going on our college campuses. And I've got here an article from the International New York Times. Campuses cautiously train freshmen against subtle insults. A freshman tentatively raises her hand, takes the microphone. I'm really scared to ask this, she begins. When I, as a white female, listen to music that uses the N-word and I'm in the car, especially when I'm in with all white friends, is it okay to sing along? The answer from Sherry Marlowe, the new chief diversity officer at Clark University, is an unequivocal no. These are, quote, microaggressions. Oh, yeah. And what about the segregated housing for the females that feel violated? Maybe they notice a guy checking them out or a guy saying, hey, you look pretty today. That would be a microaggression, highlighting the person's gender as opposed to appreciating them as a human being. That could be considered a microaggression. Maybe they'll need segregated housing for females. And then what about others, other minorities? What about fat people that feel when they see sports teams performing and sports teams getting a lot of credit that they feel left out and judged because they're unable to perform the same way? Will they need segregated housing? And what about the Christians that are dissed by professors in classes all the time? Will they need segregated housing? Is my conclusion to all this. But we come back. I want to open up the scriptures and talk about understanding the times and the seasons. And let me ask you this question. In your mind, what is the biggest issue we're facing in America today? If you had to say the number one biggest problem we have in America today is fill in the blank, what would that be? 866-34-TRUTH.
Change the world. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to The Line of Fire broadcast. Ooh, let me not forget this. It's Wednesday, so if you're listening live, you know it's Wednesday. And that means tomorrow is, come on, all together, Thursday. That's it. It is Thursday tomorrow. So after the broadcast tonight, fly into New York City. And then we begin our ministry tomorrow morning in Queens. If you're a pastor or leader, join me, at Kingdom Partners Network, Living Word Christian Fellowship. That's Cross Bay Boulevard in Ozone Park, New York, starting at 9 in the morning. All right. So if you're a pastor or leader only, 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, you've got my personal invite to be there with us at Living Word Christian Fellowship in Ozone Park. And then tomorrow night, Thursday night, a special listeners rally hosted by Chosen People Ministries. I'm going to be giving an eye-opening talk on Isaiah 53, the rabbis and the Messiah. Open to the public, free. That's 7 to 9 p.m. tomorrow night in Brooklyn at the Feinberg Messianic Center, 1974 Coney Island Avenue. We will be receiving a love offering to help with our radio ministry and Jewish outreach, so we'd love for you to participate, that it is free and open to the public. And then Friday night, Harvest Fields Community Church in the Bronx, 7:30 p.m., 2626 East Tremont Avenue in the Bronx. That's Friday night. Then Saturday morning, September 10th, Congregation Shaarei HaShemayim, led by Messianic Rabbi Ron Corbett, 2740 Martin Avenue in Belmore, starting at 11 in the morning. And then another listener rally hosted by Chosen People Ministries in New York City, in Manhattan, at 2 West 64th Street in Manhattan, Israel and the U.S. presidential election, comparing the positions of the candidates with the Bible. So we're going to have a great time. And then Sunday morning, I'll be back at Living Word Christian Fellowship in Queens, and then speaking Sunday afternoon in Glen Cove, Long Island. I'll give you more of those details as we get closer to the weekend. But I hope to see you, especially at our listener rallies Thursday night, Saturday night. But take advantage of all of these meetings. We've got some great hosts taking care of us and getting us around. So can't wait to be with you in Queens, in the Bronx, in Brooklyn, Manhattan, Long Island, in these next few days. That's why I'm coming, to be with all of you in greater New York. 866-348-7884. Biggest problem in America, number one problem America is facing today. And this takes some thought. I mean, obviously, only God knows the exact answer to that. But as I think about it, as I wonder about it, just getting some answers immediately from a colleague, the collapse of the family, especially among lower-income Americans. That's number one greatest problem we're facing in America today. Another, the church facing losing religious rights. Another, lack of all-of-life marriage. This is what builds strong nations. If we can't find peace in our own living rooms, we won't find it in our streets. Stable families make stable children, who make more stable families as a rule. Another answer, condition of our hearts. What do you think? Going to go to the phones in a moment. 866-34-TRUTH. In your view, what is the number one biggest problem that America is facing today? Is it the economy? Is it being divided? Is it terrorism? Is it a compromised church? Is it abortion? Is it the attack on marriage and family? What is it in your view? 866-34-TRUTH. Okay, so Jesus weeps over Jerusalem in Luke chapter 19. He weeps over Jerusalem, and he says, if only you had known why I was here, if only you had known the purpose of my time here, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. You did not recognize what time it was. Your kairos moment, the time of your visitation. As I look in the NIV study notes, It says, in the Cultural Background Bible, to verses 42 to 44 of Luke 19, within a generation, Rome's army would surround Jerusalem and then destroy it in the year AD 70. The survivors would be slaughtered or enslaved. Verse 44, not leave one stone on another. This may be hyperbole, but it did underline the traumatic devastation and makes a verbal connection with verse 4 about the stones crying out. Ironically, the people in Jerusalem could have averted this fate had they embraced the vision of the kingdom Jesus offered them. The temple has still not been rebuilt almost 2,000 years later. Why? The Jewish people missed their time of visitation. Oh, of course, Jewish people can be saved like everyone else, and God has kept his promises to Israel, preserved the Jewish people. And I believe that there are promises still in store for the Jewish people. But the devastation of rejecting the Messiah is still something we feel and experience to this very day. So back in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, there's a list of the mighty men, the men of war, who joined together in David's kingdom in Hebron to establish the kingdom in his hands. 1 Chronicles 12, verse 23, it begins to give a list of these warriors, the men armed for battle who came to David to turn Saul's kingdom over to him in Hebron. So from Judah, carrying shield and spear, 6,800 armed from battle. From Simeon, warriors ready for battle, 7,100, and so on. From Ephraim, brave warriors, famous in their own clans, 20,800. When you get to verse 32, though, it's the smallest group, and it doesn't mention weaponry or battle training. It says this, from Issachar, men who understood the times and knew what Israel should do. 200 chiefs with all their relatives under their command. It is one thing to get all excited about the end times and, oh, look, this headline, it lines up with Bible prophecy. Oh, look at this. Oh, look at that. And many times it's sensationalistic, and many times as the headlines change from year to year, it doesn't seem to line up so much anymore. But it's another thing to understand what is happening in a culture. What is God doing? Where are the people going? What is Satan doing? To understand what's happening and to know what we should do. What does it matter if you can chart everything on the prophetic calendar, so to say? And I always urge people, if you're keeping a prophetic calendar, do it in pencil, all right? So if you are charting every year, oh, we're at this time, it's okay, it's this time and 20 years before Jesus comes, or this or that, and you got it all figured out, but you don't know what we're supposed to do. What good is that? All right, the stock market is going to get super volatile. I've got no money in stocks, but let's say I did. Okay, what am I supposed to do then? Do I pull out? Do I buy in? What do I? Okay, it's a crazy time in our nation. Okay, what are we supposed to do? We need to be children of Issachar who understand the times and know what Israel should do. In the little role that I play, I do my best on the radio, in writing articles, books, and preaching and teaching, to do my best to help us understand the hour in which we live in and how we should be responding. I taught on these things last night, and I'm going to go to the phones momentarily. So as soon as I'm done introducing this, I'm going straight to the phones. 866-34-TRUTH. So I taught on this last night to the first year at Fire School of Ministry in our Jesus Revolution class, a class I teach every year for our first-year students. And I talk about what happened in our culture and, say, from 1960 until today, the shifts that took place and how much of it shifted in the 60s. And I acknowledge the problems we had in our society, the segregation and lack of equal opportunity for women and things like that. And yet, America was clearly a more family-friendly, innocent society 50 years ago than today. So I begin to explain what happened in the 60s, how we got where we are, the major cultural events that took place, the world events, the spiritual events, everything from Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech to the assassination of JFK to the war in Vietnam to Supreme Court decisions removing organized public prayer and Bible reading from the schools to Woodstock, to the assassination of Dr. King and Robert F. Kennedy, to the Stonewall riots, gay liberation, sex, drugs, rock and roll, Beatles coming to America, on and on. We go through all this. And then I show video clips. I say, hey, let's just go back and look. Let's look at the Beatles in 1965 Shea Stadium. Look at how innocent it all seemed to be at that stage with Ed Sullivan introducing them. They first came on his show in 64, watched by most of America. And then we go from there. Just 2 years later, Monterey Pop, The Who, destroying their equipment, their guitars and drums at the Monterey Pop Festival. And the next year, Beatles singing Revolution. And next year, Woodstock. And it's happened many a time, but it happened last night. Students just broke down crying. In fact, when I went to end the class, there was one dear student just crying, began to sob, just with such pain for the lostness of this generation and where we find ourselves today. And I said, look, it happened because the church did not recognize the spiritual search going on in the midst of the counterculture revolution. We slept our way through it. And then when the Jesus revolution happened and so many young people got saved like me, the church did not capitalize on the harvest. That's why we are today. We'll be right back with your calls.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm hoping that readers will come to understand that even though the Bible is written for us, it wasn't written to us. It was written in another language, to another culture, with all of the cultural assumptions that went along with that. Because when we take our Western, modern culture and impose it on the text, we're putting in meaning that wasn't there. And we're missing the meaning that the text has.
Next hour. So if you don't get the next hour on your local radio stations, you can listen on our radio feed right online, thelineoffire.org. I'll be talking with Professor John Walton, the editor of the Old Testament portion of the NIV Cultural Background Study Bible, to find out more about getting this Bible for yourself. You'll see it right on the homepage on our radio website, thelineoffire.org. What time is it? What's the greatest problem we're facing in America today? 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Newark, New Jersey. We start with Moses. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, good afternoon, I'm Dr. Brown.
Good afternoon.
Love your show. I used to call on a long time before, but because of my job, I'm not able to as much. But I just want to address your question.
Yes, go ahead. Are you speaking directly into the phone, sir? Just having a slight hard time hearing you.
I'm speaking through a headphone. Let me take off the headphone.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, a little bit better. We'll do our best. Go ahead.
Basically, I just want to address the number one issue. My mind is sin and the justification of sin. And not only in the world, because we expect that from the world, but also in the church that you're speaking about. Sometimes we get so complacent. We get so used to sin. And we don't take any action against it.
Yeah, let me just jump in because it's very hard to hear you. First, thanks for calling in again. It is good to hear from our old friend Moses from Newark. All right, so in case you didn't hear clearly, he was saying the number one problem, which is occurring in the church as well, is the justification of sin, that sin is no longer sin. It's either justified because we lower our standards, so, hey, no big deal, everybody does it, or we justify it by saying it's not a choice. It's a disease. Alcoholism, drunkenness is not a sin. It's a disease. Or people are just handicapped. But the justification of sin, not just in the society, but in the church. All right, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. Sorry I had to cut in, but we're just getting a lot of feedback there. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Eric in Baltimore. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, this is it. I think the number thing we need is a national leadership. We need it to, so that it can transcend down to the state level, the family, the churches, and I don't think we have that in either presidential candidate or anywhere else. I think that's what we need.
Got it. So you don't see, obviously, in the political side, you mentioned that we don't have a national leader that we can rally around or that can set a good example, but you feel that we don't have that in the church world either.
Not in a broader base, no.
Uh-huh,
I think
uh-huh.
we have church leadership. I go to a church that has a strong leadership in the church itself, but not a broader leadership across churches or, you know.
Got it.
I think
right.
I think Donald Trump has the good sentiment about making America great, but I knew of him for a long time, but you know I cannot say that he represents the leadership that I would have 100% confidence in.
Got it. Yeah, understood. All right, I appreciate that. Many times, as the leaders go, the nation goes. Do we have clear national voices for the church? Are there those that are setting example that others can rally around, rally behind on the broad basis across the country? 866-348-7884. Let's go to Chris in Queens, New York. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Brown. Let me first say that you have a very young voice. I don't know if anyone's ever told you that. When I first heard you, I thought you were much younger than what you are.
how old did you think I was?
Oh, boy. I'd say like 40s, 30s, 40s. You have a very young voice.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, 61, but my voice is the same as my heart, feeling very young and invigorated. But thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes.
Maybe one day when I'm like 120, I'll sound like this. But for now, yeah, glad to have the young voice. Thank you, sir. I really appreciate that.
Yes, Dr. Brown. Well, I'm a black male. I'm in my 30s, and I'm just like pondering about black people, like, and in terms of their politics, I sort of understand why they have voted Democrat for the past 50, 60 years or so. But it's like, you know, I've heard what you were saying about this school segregation thing, and I'm thinking, how come black people allow themselves to be manipulated in such a way? You know, if like every election the Democrats can count on the blacks to vote for them in droves like this, why is it that a group of people have historically allowed themselves to be manipulated like this? Even in these times where, as Donald Trump says, you see that there's no change. In fact, things are getting worse with violence and poverty and all those things. And it's like, I don't want to say all black people, because I'm certainly not in that category. They can't seem to get out of this rut. It's like a woman who's in an abusive relationship, and everyone's telling her to leave the abusive man, and she's, oh, I love him,
yeah.
I can't leave. I can't figure it out.
Yeah, well, the best answer to it, Chris, is that there has been a concerted effort to put black Americans in a category of dependency on the government and a continual state of victimhood. So rather than helping and empowering, the policies now create perpetual voters who are dependent. And by the way, I'm blaming everyone but black Americans saying that. In other words, I'm looking at black Americans here as victims of wrong policies that some believe that it's intentional to keep black Americans down. Let's put the best construction on it, that Americans trying to fix things after segregation and recognizing what's wrong now want to come up with all these benefits and help, but basically do it in a way that drives the man out of the house so that the woman gets more benefits, creates now a fatherless society. So illegitimacy grows 300-400% since the early days of the civil rights movement. And now, well, you have to vote for those people because the other one's helping you. So one of my guests, a black guest, said that we went from I believe it was a black guest who said that we went from a situation where you just had black workers, you know, slaves. Now you just have black voters. If you check out Jesse Lee Peterson's book, The Antidote, I know he's controversial, but I think you'll find that really helpful. And to see how Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson have hurt more than helped. The Antidote by Jesse Lee Peterson. Ultimately, though, the key thing is we each take responsibility for our own lives, no excuses, and we move forward with God's help.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Take me down.
That was the sound of Hillsong United performing live on the Today Show. Justin Justice reports, on Charisma Magazine. Lead vocalist Tyus Smith led the worship band in one of today's most popular praise anthems as the host looked on with tear-filled eyes. Some will look at that and say, awesome, they're bringing the gospel to secular TV. Others will say, ah, it's a compromised gospel. Still more to talk about. 866-348-7884. When I asked on Twitter, fill in the blank, what is the number one most critical issue America is facing today? Another comment, the first one is sin by unbelief in God's word. Then they talk about we're all Christians, but we're so far from God. Another comment, political correctness, which muffles God's truth. Another, ungodliness. Another, not believing Jesus Christ died for the sins of the world and rose again to predestine us to eternal salvation. Now, those, a lot of those are very Christian answers. But is that the answer right there? The greatest problems in America are gospel-based. That's where we have our lacks. That's where we find our solution. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to New Jersey. Reverend Christian, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
To me, I think that the number one problem facing America today is I will call it genocide, actually. Genocide, you know, with the active gay community planning to indoctrinate children into the life of homosexuality, you know, starting from the ages 3 to 5 kindergartners, you know what I mean? So, to me, I feel that you can't teach a child to lie. You can't teach a child to gossip. I know that all sin is sin, but when you are trying to teach children at that age how to think alternative lifestyle, to me, I think that's genocide that is about to hit our society today.
Yeah, and obviously, when you use the word genocide, that's a very strong word. But
yes,
the fact is, there is a desire to indoctrinate, to get kids, yes, 3, 4, 5 years old, nursery school, preschool, and coming into kindergarten, to give them definitions of terms of gay, transgender, and to basically say sometimes boys like boys and girls like girls, and sometimes there's a boy in a girl's body and a girl in a boy's body, and to introduce kids at ages before they even understand these things to these different concepts, to even declare war on gender, present different meanings of family. And then look, your average little boy, he doesn't like girls. And when you tell a 6-year-old boy, Susie likes you, maybe he's actually gay then because he doesn't like girls. You start, that's complete nonsense to plant these thoughts. I'd be all for it, sir, if little children were taught, be nice to everyone. I'd be all for that. And if someone seems a little different from you, don't make fun of them, be nice to them. Yes, you can teach that bullying and cruelty are bad without teaching that gay and transgender are good. And for those that don't know how far things have gone in the school system, get my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America. Get the book and read the chapter in our children's schools. It came out in 2011. Things have gotten even worse than then. But you'll read the book with shock. You'll read the book with pain. That's the reality. Be nice to everyone? Yes. Be kind to everyone? Yes. Indoctrinate 3, 4, 5-year-olds into the goals of transgender activism? God forbid. We'll be right back.
It
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Let's see some other Twitter responses to my question about what is the greatest problem in America today. Lack of understanding about the holiness of God and the wrath of God, even among many so-called Christian churches. So I'm saying the problem's in the church. In other words, if the salt loses its saltiness, right? Or if the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? That's obviously often relevant. Let's go to Ellery in Bowie, Maryland. Thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Quickly, I think family, specifically separated and distracted men, is America's biggest problem. You have so many men in jail, so many men who are addicted to sports, and they'll sit out in, you know, zero-degree weather watching football, but you can't get them to read a book. Mm-hmm. And men are a natural firewall appointed by God, and then there's this lack of understanding of generationality. You know, the word says Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it includes me, but it's not about me. And we have a narcissism growing with social media, and so when you've got all those elements, the enemy can just come in and wreak havoc. And then, too, I just want to quickly say, Joshua said, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So we got to have men willing to stand up and lead their house no matter what's going on. And my personal prayer is just that men will get on their faces, fast, and pray, get back to laying hands on their sons and calling up their manhood. And then, finally, the proverb says, the glory of children is their fathers. And we need fathers to be fathers, not just biologically, but spiritually and socially.
Yeah, Ellery, articulate, clear, nothing to add to that. Wonderful insights, wonderful call. May we take heed to those words. Thank you. 866-348-7884. Let's go to New York City. Obadiah, welcome to The Line of Fire.
God bless you. Listen, I think what Jesus said, the prayers of a righteous person avail much. I believe that our nation, we need to stop praying more and more and living before this, our country, before the people, that they can see that we love the Lord. But we've got to pray and pray more. But pray. I find that the more I pray, it just gives me much more strength to witness, to serve the Lord. Mm. That's my little thought.
Yeah, you know, and I agree with everything. It's so simple, isn't it? If we would really get hold of God in prayer and really love other people more, wouldn't that shake the nation? 866-34-TRUTH. In Baltimore, Denise, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, I think that men have failed as society has progressed to define an essential role for themselves. It used to be the live-in home repairmen, or they used to make sure that the cars were taken care of. They used to be those that you could depend on for some defined role in society that is no longer there. When you go to take your car now to the car shops, men are sitting in the chairs, you know, before women can get to the chairs. They leave the responsibility for lawn care to the women of the house, and they're out riding bikes or doing whatever it is. I think they haven't defined a role, so much so that now society tends to ridicule men. They're always as the butt of the joke in the commercials, the butt of the jokes in the TV shows. And women, on the other hand, we've maintained the role of the homemaker. And of course, I know there's some men who do an excellent job of that. Those are characteristics that they have adopted, but they left that defining, that male defining characteristic or that male defining role behind.
Yeah, Denise, you know, it's what you're saying is true on a few levels. It's true in terms of our whole culture, kind of not our whole culture, but a lot of it ridicules manhood and ridicules male strength. I'm not talking about bigoted chauvinism or pigheadedness. I'm talking about a man being a man and being a protector and being a real father and being there for his wife and being dependable. And the wife can rest assured that the husband's responsible and leading the way. A lot of that gets ridiculed. We've come a very long way from shows like Father Knows Best. And then many have pointed out to even an increasing feminization in the church, where it's all about being sensitive and soft, and there is not the place for the man to be a strong man. So yeah, there's a lot of this in the culture, and then with broken homes, kids don't have good role models. So and then women, you know, there's a strength that women have that men don't have. We understand that. But there's another aspect in which women are the weaker vessel. I mean, just physically, we understand that on average. And instead of women saying that to the men, we need you to be who you need to be, society's telling the women, no, you need to do it all. So it is kind of a dual attack, and then the attack on gender distinctions in general. So it's definitely an issue. And, you know, Nancy, my wife, is the strongest woman that I know, and just immovable, unshakable in so many ways. And yet she 100% looks to me to be the head of the home. Now, by the way, I'm not a handyman or a repairman. So if something goes wrong, we got to get it fixed, or she's got her own toolbox, actually. But she knows I've got to carry the burden spiritually, emotionally, financially, so that if attack comes, if pressure comes, that falls on me. And that when it's crucial life and death time, which way do we go? She expects me to lead the way. Again, she is the strongest person I know. And I rely on her practical wisdom for everyday things far more than she relies on mine. But in terms of the buck stops, the leadership, the carrying it, that's my role as a man. And yes, many ways lacking in society. And then the culture fights against it. So Denise, thank you for weighing in as a woman and reminding us men of the importance of us taking our role. I believe in general that if you've got people with right attitudes, if men will lead well in that regard, then women would follow in terms of the right leadership role men should have. And then there's the mutuality of interaction and submission that comes in a healthy marriage and relationship. All right, a lot to think about. Thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Tony in Edison, New Jersey. Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hey.
I've called you before, but it was a long time ago. But anyways, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, this ridiculousness with all this gay train, I can't even remember all the initials. But North Carolina went and passed a law that every state should have been able to pass, and they were boycotted by the NFL and other people. Now, us as a Christian community, Bible-believing, God-believing Christians should boycott anybody who boycotts or hurts us. We got to love, but we got to flex our muscles sometime too, and it's time to flex our muscle. You gotta be bold. You gotta get out there and say the truth, even though it is not in and out of season. I can't quote the scripture, but in and out of season, you have to say the truth to people, whether they're believers or not. It's just what you have to do. I will not watch another NFL game. I've been boycotting Target since 2002 because I'm a veteran. I did 24 years. I was in the VA, and veterans, people asked for some donations, and Target sent them a message saying, no, we give to no Veterans Affairs projects. We only give to homosexual, whatever it was. But anyways, that's what they said. I've been boycotting them since then. If everybody just turned off the football games and didn't go to New York State parks, and the other people don't buy Bruce Springsteen albums, and you'll see we have some muscle, Dr. Brown.
Yeah, you know, Tony, the thing, of course, is that right now I'm going to be flying after the radio broadcast into New York City on American Airlines. And American Airlines certainly is vocal in its support of gay activism, as are most of the major airlines I could fly in America. I'll be using credit cards that support gay activism. The computer in front of me is probably made by a company that supports it. my cell phone. In other words, it's so pervasive in society. And yet, when a line is crossed, like Target crossing that line, yeah, I believe it was good to send a message. And they're hearing that message saying, look, we have an expectation of privacy, and we're looking for the safety of those there, and we don't want a loophole that heterosexual predators can take advantage of, etc. That's a right thing to do, to send a message. And North Carolina has been thriving as a state economically. These were our laws before. Radical activists in the city of Charlotte, North Carolina, I live in North Carolina now, radical activists in the city of Charlotte passed a destructive bill. The state overturned it to put things back basically the way they were before. We were doing fine before. Let's stand strong and keep doing fine. We reach out to everyone, gay, straight, with the same message of Jesus. But let's not bow down to the activism. Thank you. God of light,
hear our cry. Send the fire. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, a few more Twitter comments. The greatest problems we have in America today. Ungodliness, not believing Jesus Christ died for the sins of the world, rose again to predestine us to eternal salvation. I think I read those before. Yeah, I did. A division, the overreach of the judicial branch. I think we, including myself, have failed to give our children the foundations of God's basic principles, period. Dismissing of truth, humility before the Creator, Yahweh. Back to the phones on Long Island. Lynette, welcome to the Line of Fire.
God bless you, Dr. Brown. Thank you so much for taking my comments. I feel that there is one problem that actually spawns all the rest of the problems that have been mentioned already, and that is biblical illiteracy. Jesus even said that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And I feel that this is a problem within the church and outside the church, and particularly within the church, when we have so many people that have been members for, in some instances, for decades, but have never read portions, major portions of the Bible, never read them themselves, never studied them. It weakens the prayer life. It weakens our thinking. How are we going to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength when we are completely malnourished? And I think that that's really something that spawns all of the other problems. In economics, the Bible says you will not make the shekel great. In other words, you won't do things that you know are going to cause inflation and throw the entire economic system of the country into a free fall.
Yeah.
And obviously the family and everything, of race relations, everything. I think that the LGBT community, all of it, I think that the lack of testing everything according to the word and the attitude that I haven't read the Bible until it's reading me, that spawns all of the other problems.
Yeah, and Lynette, I'm thinking of a physical analogy. My mom's been in the hospital or getting some special treatment. She's almost 94, and I was just with her every day. I was just with her again before radio today, and she's definitely getting stronger because she's eating better. And she started to deteriorate, and she wasn't eating as well, and she was having eating-related problems. Now that she's eating better, getting more nutrition, she's getting stronger, even at a frail weight and state, and almost 94. Well, it's the same for us as believers, that we would get healthier if we took in the word more, really took it in and really studied and really asked God to speak to us through the word, and then really sought to put it into practice, and then made that known in our teaching and preaching on a wider basis. So there is a plague of biblical illiteracy in America, within the church, often even within the pulpit. And because of that, Christians are malnourished, and because of that, the nation is not pointed in the right direction by those that should be having that influence. I have a whole book coming out about a year from now where I address some of these very issues. But again, some of it's so simple. It's so simple, and yet it's such a major hurdle. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's grab one more call in Boston. Geneva, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Oh, hi, Dr. Brown. First of all, I want to say, if any of you can support Dr. Brown's ministry, it is so important to do so, so that we can keep him on the air. His voice is really needed. And also, praying for your mom. Just want to let you know that.
Well, thank you. And I do recall you encouraging folks to stand with us before. So thank you so much for your heart in doing that, Geneva. Much appreciated.
Oh, you're welcome. I feel that the biggest problem today throughout the world is the internet and social media. The internet acts as a voyeurism where everyone knows everybody's business. People go online to connect with, check other people out, or to look at pornography. But also, if you think about the internet as stones, or people in biblical days, they would stone a person. Well, the internet, the things that people type on Twitter and on the internet, it's like stoning people, always stoning people and, you know, putting people down, you know, and building themselves up. And also, it reminds me of the Tower of Babel, when people were trying to get high, you know, reach God, and God destroyed them for trying to, and he scattered their voices, and they couldn't communicate with each other. This is, the internet, I feel, is a tool that the devil is using to bring everybody's voice together, and something that was made for good is now being used for evil. And I think it's ironic that the other day when the rocket blew up, that it was carrying Facebook's satellite. I don't know. That's just my opinion, Dr.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, a lot of people, Geneva, found some irony or even some unfortunate perverse delight in that because of dislike for Mark Zuckerberg or Facebook. But the fact is, yeah, internet, social media, it's brought out more of the worst of us than the best in us. Yeah. It's been used to get the gospel to places it could never get to before, and it's been used to get porn to places it could never get to before. But when you look at generally what's on social media, the way things are reported, in many ways it's brought out the worst in us versus the best. And on top of that, it has also been a massive distraction, which is a challenge for me every single day because I'm so connected and so much going on online, how to pull away and focus. Hey, thank you for weighing in. And again, thanks for praying for my mom and for encouraging support. If you value this voice on your radio as you're listening or getting the podcast or listening live online, we do it through your help. We do it through your help. Go to my website now, thelineoffire.org, and just click on donate to stand with us. All right. Just go to thelineoffire.org. You can read my latest article. Is CNN now the censoring news network? You can watch my latest video on social issues. Transgender activists treat parents as enemies. This is all on the website. You can check out our special resource offer. And you can stand with us financially. Become a monthly torchbearer or give a one-time gift. So if you're blessed by the broadcast, do what Scripture says. And help in return. Galatians 6, let him who's taught in the word share all good things with his teacher. In this case, you're just enabling us to keep getting the message out to you. So click on donate to stand with us at thelineoffire.org. And together, we will continue to make a difference. So how do we sum things up? Hard to isolate any one thing as the greatest problem in America today. But if you want to make it really simple, the greatest need is for the church to be the church, for God's people to be God's people, for children of God to live like children of God. If we could really take hold of him, and through that he takes hold of us more deeply, and we function as salt and light in the society, and we pray as we should pray, America will be massively impacted for the good. My bottom line today, what then is the greatest need in America today? Let's boil it down. The church must be the church. I'm about to speak with one of the world's leading scholars on the cultural background to the Old Testament.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, I am having a blast every day reading excerpts from the Cultural Background Study Bible on the air and off the air. Look at this. On Joshua 10, 2+ pages on the sun stands still and the moon stops. Wow. Fascinating. I'm going to be joined momentarily by Professor John Walton, who did the massive job of editing the Old Testament portion of this incredible study Bible. And then my friend, Professor Craig Keener, had the massive job of doing the New Testament portion. So I'm going to be joined by Dr. John Walton momentarily. But first, let's just get into some recent news. Joey, clip number 13. This is WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange on Sean Hannity's broadcast last night. And he's got some provocative comments. Clip number 13. All right. We got it, Joey. Go ahead. Okay. We've got a problem with that clip. Joey, can we play another clip? Or is it, are all of our clips fouling up right now? WikiLeaks has said that there's going to be a bombshell announcement or another release of information perhaps next week, and specifically having to do with Hillary Clinton. Are they targeting Hillary Clinton rather than Donald Trump? Or is it simply that she's got more dirt, more dirty laundry, that whatever dirt Donald Trump has, we kind of know. We know his history pretty well in terms of problems and issues and the three marriages and boasting about adulteries and all the other things and the way he's treated other people. But could it be that there's just more dirt pertaining to Hillary Clinton? All right, so we're not gonna play those clips. We just have a glitch with our equipment for a moment. Joey, what you got to do is get the hamster running faster to generate more energy there. And if that hamster runs faster, that the energy will just pump up there, and we can get that computer running fast. Just messing around. Just messing around. So, I believe, as many do, that there is much more under the surface to come to the surface with regarding to scandals relating to the Clintons. And the way the elections are going right now, the tide has been turning. If, as many problems as I've had with candidate Trump, he does seem to be listening more to the counsel around him. He's now getting his message out, got his immigration message out, getting a defense message out. Will he stick to his guns? What will he do when elected? Those are all valid questions. But in my view, if he stays on message and doesn't get distracted with petty fights with others that are non-consequential, that he could easily win the election. Hillary Clinton right now is becoming more toxic than Donald Trump. And all you need is one or two more scandalous things. I mean, this would have sunk enough other people up to now if it wasn't Hillary Clinton. And it's still mind-boggling that the FBI didn't indict her. But it seems to be one thing after another after another. And now, you know, a prominent rapper telling young black youth, don't vote for Hillary. What have the Democrats done for us? Don't vote for us so quickly. That does not portend well either. But bottom line, we pray for God's best. We pray for God's will. And then we vote with wisdom. We come back. We are switching over to the world of the Old Testament. Get ready to time travel back several thousand years.
Cleansing flame, send the It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. I am really delighted to have Professor John Walton with me, the Old Testament editor for the NIV Cultural Background Study Bible that we've been promoting now the last couple of weeks. We had on the air for a full hour Professor Craig Keener, a dear friend and colleague of mine, the New Testament editor. Now we have the Old Testament editor, Professor John Walton. He's a professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College, taught for many years before that at Moody. And if someone asked me, okay, who are the two people you want to put together for a team to edit a Bible like this, Old Testament, New Testament, it'd be about a millisecond of thought. And the answer, John Walton for the Old Testament, Craig Keener for the New Testament. John, it's a delight to welcome you to the Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be here, Michael.
When I was writing a commentary on Jeremiah for the revised edition of the Expositor's Bible Commentary, whenever I had to just sort out some thorny geographical issue or historical issue, I grabbed the volume you edited, the IVP Bible Background Commentary to the Old Testament, and often just quoted it. I thought, well, that says it better than I could say it. And then your Job application commentaries, I was doing a standalone for Job. I thought, man, great insights just on a spiritual, practical level. So now to see this Bible out, I am so thrilled that the general public can get what you and Craig and other scholars have been working on for years. So what's your own origin? How did you get into this to become such a specialist in cultural backgrounds to the Bible?
It actually began mostly in my doctoral work when I started to recognize how important the cultural world was for interpretation. I went to Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, and the idea that not just archaeology, but ancient literature, that could really impact our understanding began to take root then, and I got very interested in that. I did my dissertation on the Tower of Babel to try to explore the cultural background of that account, and it's just kind of rolled on from there.
Very, very interesting. And the study program that you had at Hebrew Union would have been similar to what I had at NYU in terms of learning the ancient languages. So what languages did you begin to study and learn, and what literature did you start to study and learn to equip you to better understand the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament?
Well, like the program at NYU, we studied both the history and the literature and the languages. Both, that's all three, history, literature, and languages. I had to study most of them, Ugaritic and Akkadian and Aramaic and things of that sort. I found Akkadian the most useful, not because it's closer to the Israel in terms of distance, but just because with the great extent of literature that was available. So in that sense, I was introduced to that broad range of literature and found that very, very helpful for interpretation.
Yeah, and you have a love for the Scriptures. This is not just an intellectual pursuit. You want people to get excited about the Word of God.
Yeah, in the end, to me, you know, my audience is the church. Certainly, I hope that the Academy gets some help out of some of the things that I do, but I consider myself as involved in bridge work, taking the information that sometimes is very difficult to grasp or even find from the Academy and bring that into usefulness for the church.
Yeah, absolutely. And a massive amount of work here. I so appreciate it. Many will stand indebted to you and Craig and the team that assisted you. All right. My reading of Scripture last day or two, I've been reading through the minor prophets. So let's grab a minor prophet. Let's take Amos. He does tell us when he prophesied, so we're supposed to know. How does it help me to understand background, cultural background to the book of Amos? You can be as general or as specific as you like.
Yeah. You know, in the background commentary, whether it's Amos or any of the other books, we focus on certain kinds of information. You know, lots of study Bibles try to help with interpretation in general, and they give random pieces of information. They do some theology, maybe some application. But in the Cultural Background Study Bible, we're trying to focus on very specific issues. We want to do archaeology, geography, the manners and customs, the ancient literature, the ways of thinking, you know, those kinds of ideas, all to get us in touch with the world of the Bible and the ancient world. With a book like Amos, it's certainly helpful to look at the history of the period and to know what's going on in the history, you know, what's going on with the empires of the world, how Israel is faring with all of that, the economy of the period. All of those are very helpful things. But even beyond that, to look at the message of Amos and to try to figure out how this message was coming across in the ancient world. How were people thinking then? Obviously, Amos deals with a lot of economic issues, but he's dealing with not with a market economy, not with capitalism, not with the kinds of things that we have in our economy. He's dealing with an ancient economy. And those kinds of things can help us as we understand the situation in Israel when he was prophesying.
Yeah, and as I look at the Illustrated Bible Backgrounds commentary, as I'm looking at it, for the opening chapters, Amos's judgments against foreign nations, and there's a map. He kind of puts a giant X over Israel. Starts in one corner, then the other, you know, goes from north, south, and kind of a giant X, and then gets a little closer with Judah, and then the rest of the book is about Israel. But just something that simple, having a map as you're reading it, it makes a difference, doesn't it?
That's our hope, that the that the maps will be helpful as people get their orientation, get the setting down pat, just to know kind of how close these countries are. I mean, in America, we're used to the idea that our enemies are oceans away. And here, the Philistines, you know, the Philistine Pentapolis is 25, 30 miles from Jerusalem. Mm. And so things like that, that there's that proximity, which increases the threat.
All right. Say in Hosea, I'm looking at a two-page article on the Baal in Hosea. There's even a statue, an image of a Baal, of a particular deity that was worshipped. You even have some language in Hebrew. You're not going to call me Baali anymore, which would have been my husband, but that name shouldn't be used. So what am I going to learn, cultural background to the book of Hosea, with this concept of Baal, or Baal, as most pronounced in English?
Right. Well, lots of people, when they're reading the Bible just casually, they just think that Baal is the name of a god. But here we try to explain that that Baal is sort of a title that can serve almost as a catch-all. There are many different Baals. The Book of Judges talks about Baals early on. And so there are different Baals. And so, and each one's really quite different. And so to that extent, we have to ask the question, who is this Baal in Hosea? Which one is it? And what characterizes that Baal? You know, all of this is part of trying to understand how the divine world was thought to work in the ancient world. You know, Israel obviously was called to have a different view of God, but to try to gain appreciation and understanding of that different view, we have to know what to compare it against.
Yeah.
You know, we think in that, oh, the other peoples worshipped many gods, and Israel's supposed to worship one God. Well, yes, but that's just scratching the surface. One of the reasons why the peoples in the ancient world worshipped many gods is because for anybody in the ancient world, identity was found in community. Therefore, that's not only true of people, it's true of the gods. And so when they thought about the divine realm, they thought about a community of gods. They really had trouble imagining an individual god that was alone. It didn't make a lot of sense to them. They were also used to using different gods for different reasons, just like we would go to a general practitioner doctor, but then we have lots of specialists. And so in the ancient world, the different gods had their specialties and their jurisdictions, and you'd choose the appropriate god for the appropriate thing. So it's not just a numbers game in the ancient world. And all of this comes into trying to understand how people thought in the ancient world so we can understand the text in light of that.
Yeah, there's even the extraordinary passage in Jeremiah 44 where the Judean exiles have fled to Egypt And they tell Jeremiah, you know, when we were worshiping all these other gods, everything was good for us. And once we got away from that, that's when things got bad. I mean, it's mind-boggling, right? But that would be the mentality. All right, friends, I've got a bunch more questions for Professor John Walton. And you can now benefit from his decades of research by getting your own copy of the NIV Cultural Backgrounds Study Bible, 2,350 pages total. Every page, amazing background, geographical, archaeological, comparing it to ancient literature. And I'm going to raise some questions that many struggle with. I mean, is the Bible just copying pagan myths and borrowing pagan literature? Remember, you can get the Bible, we'll pay the postage, and include my full interview with Professor Craig Keener, 2 hours. Go to AskDrBrown.org.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. If you have a question for Professor John Walton, an Old Testament question, you're curious about the background to a particular passage or something in historical context, by all means, give us a call, and we'll do our best to get to some questions as well. 866-348-7884. That's 866-34-TRUTH. The NIV Cultural Backgrounds Study Bible, now available. You can get your copy. We'll pay the postage and give you with it free a 2-hour interview with Professor Craig Keener to listen to on your computer or MP3 player. That's by going to AskDrBrown, askdrbrown.org. So resuming with Professor John Walton. John, I was exposed early on in college, taking my first ancient history class, to a learned scholar, a professor who had done a lot of work in Assyriology, and he bought into a total critical reading of the scripture, that the Bible is just another ancient book against this ancient background and probably borrows from Babylonian flood accounts and Babylonian creation accounts. So it's just, it's got its own twist, but it's just one myth among other myths. Obviously, you were confronted with this with scholars that didn't believe things the same way we do. How did you work that out without running from investigation, rather running to it? How did you sort these things out for yourself?
Well, I really had to sit down and think through what is it that's going on, what's being suggested, what's the evidence for it, things of that sort. One of the first books I wrote in comparative studies was called Ancient Israelite Literature in Its Cultural Context. And I dealt with some of those questions about borrowing and what evidence there was for it and how similar were they really. They're complicated issues, but I think in the end they are easily resolvable. That is, if we understand that the Israelites were embedded in the ancient world, then we don't necessarily have to think of them as being indebted to individual pieces of literature. For example, you know, I use the metaphor of a cultural river. In the ancient world, there's this cultural river, and all of the ideas and the ways of thinking, you know, the corporate identity, the way they think about the gods, the way they think about the world around them, the spirit world, divination, all of these things are kind of in the cultural river, and Israel's in it. We've got our own cultural river today that's got things like democracy and freedom and rights and empiricism and social media. And that's our cultural river, and they had theirs. And Israel was part of that. And sometimes God called them to swim against the currents, but they're still in the river. Sometimes they could just float on the currents and no problems. They're still in the river. And what we find is some of the things, some of the literature that kind of overlaps between Israel and the ancient world, it's really just river material. So the flood, okay? Everybody in the ancient world knows about a flood. And so that event is in the cultural river. Now, different cultures drew that event out and shaped it with their own particular interpretation of what did it all mean. They all knew there was a flood. How do you interpret something like the flood? Just like today, we might ask, how do you interpret the Holocaust?
Right.
What's happening there? You know, and they all had to interpret the flood. And of course, the Babylonians did it one way, and the Israelites did it another way. They've got a different read, a different spin, if you will, on what's going on. And it's that interpretation of the event that is what constitutes the authority of God's word. It's not the event. Everybody knows about the event. That's sitting there in the cultural river. But Israel didn't have to read a Babylonian account to learn about the event. They knew about the event. Everybody in the ancient world did. Now, they gave it their own interpretation, which we believe is an inspired interpretation.
Right.
And that carries authority for us. So the difference between being indebted, which I don't think they really were hardly ever, to being embedded. I think it's an important distinction.
Yeah, and I love the way you articulate that, making it so simple for our listeners and for your readers, and to put it in the context of that cultural river. Someone called the other day asking about Epic of Gilgamesh, or they wrote in actually, and they said, boy, does the Bible just borrow from that in the flood account? And I said, well, let's see what the Cultural Background Study Bible has to say. And sure enough, when we open it up, there's a 2-page article on the flood with a picture of the ancient cuneiform tablet dealing with the Epic of Gilgamesh. So these are things that are discussed head on. So are there times when the Bible corrects a pagan myth or says, no, it wasn't this God or that God, it was the one true God? For example, Isaiah 27, that uses language virtually identical to a Ugaritic text from, 700 years prior, where it claims that Baal slew Leviathan, this fleet serpent. And here in Isaiah 27, it says that Yahweh did it. Is that God saying, no, I'm the one true God? How does that work out culturally?
Well, I'll get to culturally, but a quick comment literarily. I mean, that's one of the striking examples where the wording is the same as what we find in an ancient text. But Isaiah is 8th century earliest, depending who you talk to. And the Ugaritic material is, 7, 8 centuries earlier. So
yep.
Where in the world would Isaiah get a copy of an Ugaritic text, assuming he could read an Ugaritic text? And the cultural river model says this wording about Leviathan and all of that is in the cultural river. Ugaritic texts drew it out and did something with it. Isaiah drew it out and did something different with it. But they both happen to draw out the same wording. Okay, so that kind of idea of understanding it. Now,
right. And by the way, in that regard, it's the same as you've got seven-headed monsters in ancient Canaanite literature. And you've got the multiple heads of Leviathan in the Psalms, and then you have a seven-headed monster, Satan, in the Book of Revelation. It's all that cultural river.
Exactly.
And by the way, growing up in New York, we pronounced it Ugaritic. I think the rest of the world, Ugaritic. John, as you've taught so many generations of students, we've just got a minute before the break. How do you see the light go on with them and suddenly a lot of the fear disappears because they realize, oh, the Bible's not just copying pagan myths?
Sure. The main thing is not just to say it doesn't. The main thing is to say, how can we think about this other literature? How can we process it? How can we put it into a legitimate methodology of reading text against its ancient Near Eastern background? So you really need the methodological piece, not just a solution to this problem or that problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So these things, the larger approaches are laid out. And by the way, there's massive scholarship backing every page, but it's simply written. And at the beginning of the Bible, there are practical tips. Okay, here's what you need to learn when you pick it up, when you go through it. Their charts, give me a background, Hebrew to English, translation issues. I'm really amazed. I knew it was coming out for a while, but I'm telling you the truth. I've been amazed by how wonderfully it's been produced. We'll be back with more with Professor John Walton.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I am speaking with Professor John Walton, in my view and the view of many, the leading evangelical scholar on the cultural background to the Old Testament. And now, every reader of the Scriptures can dive into the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and get cultural background in detailed notes with graphs, with pictures, with dedicated articles. For every relevant verse going through the Old Testament where there's relevant cultural background, it's here in One Bible for the Old Testament, and then Professor Craig Keener for the New. And John Walton, thrilled that he has done this work, many decades of study put together in this. And look, this is a field I've lived in. My PhD is in Near Eastern Languages and Literatures. I've written commentaries on books of the Bible, and yet I'm constantly enriched as I'm using this. And oh, excellent point. Yeah, boy, I didn't think of that text. So terrific Bible to get. You can order it through us by going to AskDrBrown.org. We'll pay the postage and give you free my two-hour interview with Professor Craig Keener. John, before we take some calls, you mentioned the pantheon of the gods often in the cultural backgrounds commentary. And we know that some scholars talk about monolatry, so Yahweh is the chief god among other gods. And then others talk about monotheism, Yahweh is the one and only God. But you have verses like Exodus 15, Mi kamocha b'alim Adonai, who is like you among the gods, O Lord, O Yahweh. Is there a transition in the Old Testament from monolatry to monotheism?
You know, those terms, between monolatry and monotheism and even henotheism, these are terms that we use to try to sort out what we would consider metaphysical realities. I find that in the ancient world, they're not as concerned about metaphysical realities. They're more concerned about what the gods do, how they're involved, how they act. And so they don't really sort out the metaphysics, and even the way that God talks to the Israelites is not really addressing our kind of philosophical mindset that tries to sort those things out. So I'm not sure that I would say that there is a development on the metaphysical front. I'm not even sure that there's a lot of concern on the metaphysical front. God is the one who acts, a God who is acting, who is able to act, and who acts on your behalf is a God that was worthy of worship.
And how was it then, say, the ancient world would tie in worship of various deities to the agricultural flow, and you'd have a dying and rising deity, and so, of course, you're dependent on the rain. You're an agrarian society. So how did the worship of the gods, or a particular god, tie in with the whole agricultural cycle?
Well, of course, they believed that different gods had different jurisdictions, different powers, and different areas that they controlled. And so it would make sense that you would connect with the god who controlled that area. So they had gods that they believed were storm gods and gods that were fertility gods. And for that issue, they would address them. It's a bureaucracy in the ancient world among the gods, just like it is in our governments today. You know, if you had a problem with the sewer line on your street, you wouldn't call the president. That just wouldn't make any sense. You go to whatever level of government is responsible for what you want. And they thought very similarly in bureaucratic terms among the gods.
Yeah, fascinating. And what emerges, and we've just got 30 seconds before the break, then we'll come back with some callers. But the more you put the Bible against its cultural context, the more it shines. Isn't that true?
Yes. Again, we see many, many similarities, but generally the similarities are at surface level. The differences are once you penetrate deeply into the mindset, and that's where the Bible's differences from the ancient world really help us to understand it.
Right, so here, friends, is a scholar saying the solution is not thinking less. The solution is thinking more. The solution is not ignoring the issues. The solution is dig deeper. The deeper you dig, the more we see the inspiration of the Scriptures. All right, back with your calls and questions for my special guest, Professor John Walton.
Cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire, speaking with Wheaton Old Testament professor John Walton, the editor of the NIV Cultural Background Study Bible, The Old Testament. Massive amount of work behind it. Let's get to some specific questions, John. We'll start in New Bern, North Carolina. Frida, welcome to The Line of Fire. What's your question for Dr. Walton?
Hello, Dr. Brown. specifically, Deuteronomy chapter 12, 29 through 32 seems to be God is saying not to worship him in the manner that the people around you worship, you know, worship their pagan gods. And it seems to me that that's what the church has done with holidays like Christmas and Easter. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure thing. Yeah, Professor, over to you.
Well, certainly we can look at the church and the way we celebrate Easter and Christmas, and we can see what we would call syncretism. It's mixing together of things that are important spiritually in the mix of our culture and sometimes even our bad thinking. So that happens to us as well. In Deuteronomy 12, it's more particularly interested in the means that they worshipped through idols and that approach through the particular rituals that were used in the ancient world. Of course, Israel still made sacrifices, just like people around them made sacrifices. But the idea is, how do you think worship works? In the ancient world, they believed that their rituals were providing needs for the gods. In the rest of the ancient world, they believed that the gods grew hungry, and therefore they needed to eat, and sacrifices were their food. They believed the gods needed temples to live in. They needed nice clothing. They needed basically to be pampered. And in fact, that's why the gods had created people, in the way the ancient world thought, to be their slaves, to provide their needs. The main thing going on in Deuteronomy, and really lots of the Old Testament, is Yahweh, the God of Israel, says, I don't have any needs, and therefore your worship, your rituals, are not meeting my needs. Your temples are not meeting my needs. They serve a different role. And so don't think about me the way that everybody else thinks about their gods. Don't approach me with your rituals as if they're satisfying my need. It isn't that way.
Right. And as he says in Psalm 50, if I was hungry, I wouldn't tell you, obviously.
Exactly.
He's speaking in human language there. And Frida, to the extent, if there are pagan practices in Christmas and Easter, those are wrong. If it's simply a matter of there are various customs that have been adopted, and some of them are neutral, some of them are good, that's a whole other story. Thank you for the call. So if we stay there for a minute, stay in Deuteronomy, we go over to Deuteronomy, the 18th chapter. God says, don't go to soothsayers, necromancers, people who can, these different forms of trying to ascertain the future or understand the will of the gods. God will raise up a prophet for you. You've got an article here on magic at this point as well. What are some of the ways that the ancients would try to interpret omens, practice divination, you know, reading parts of the body, things like that? What did they actually do in the ancient world to try to find out the will of the gods or the future?
Right. Divination was widely used, a lot of different kinds of divination. But basically, divination is a means that was used to try to gain knowledge. Other forms of magic, like incantations and hexes and spells, were ways to wield power. So it's about power and knowledge, as those two things work in the ancient world. In the divination rituals, remember that the gods in the ancient world didn't reveal themselves. The only revelation they ever gave was through a divination process, which was fairly focused on one specific issue or another. They didn't reveal themselves the way the God of Israel had revealed himself. And so they're searching for knowledge, and divination was considered a way that they could gain that knowledge about what the gods were up to. So they talk about the gods writing their will on the skies or writing their answers into the entrails of sacrificed animals, all ways to try to gain just little bits of knowledge about God.
Yeah, and again, the dependency on the priests and then the various ways to try to get to these hidden gods who are often capricious, too. You didn't quite know what mood they'd be in, as opposed to God saying, I'm going to speak and reveal myself. That's why he keeps contrasting things. He keeps contrasting things and saying, hey, I am not like the other gods. Which other god went into a nation and brought a people out? Or which other god has laws like these laws? And if we look at something as massive as the flood, you've mentioned that the whole ancient world knew there was a flood. Ancient Near Eastern world talked about the flood in different ways. In Genesis 6, the earth is filled with wickedness and violence and has corrupted itself, so God must destroy it. What's the cause of the flood, say, in the Babylonian accounts?
Again, in the Babylonian accounts, the gods are getting frustrated. They've created people to meet their needs, but of course there are problems that come along with the package deal. There's violence among the people, but more importantly, the text talks about noise.
Yep.
And different scholars have different interpretations of the noise. Is it the noise of clamor, as people clamor to get the attention of the gods to answer their petitions? Is it the noise of disorder in society, injustice? And it could be a number of these all at once. But the idea of noise, that the human world was creating an inconvenience for the gods. And so the gods wanted to try to trim down the population. And they tried things like, you know, plague and famine and wild animals. But still, that human population was such a big problem. Again, this is where we see that the interpretation of what the flood is all about is different in these documents than what you'd find in the Bible.
And you've written a lot on the creation account, and you have a particular take on that. Of course, the study Bible will give the range of possibilities. But how should we be reading Genesis 1? It's not to say it's unscientific or anti-scientific, but why is it written? What would have been the purpose for it in light of ancient Near Eastern cosmologies where the different societies, civilizations are seeking to explain the origin of the universe or the role of their God in the origin of the universe? What's for ancient Israel, what's the purpose of the creation account?
Yeah. You know, I'm not inclined to think that they're actively trying to debunk or refute the views around them. Mm-hmm. Rather, they are simply advocating for what they see as the true way to think about it all. But still, they're operating in their own world. The Bible does not anticipate the details of our modern cultural river. It doesn't anticipate social media and tell us, you know, the ups and downs, pros and cons on social media. It deals with its own world. And likewise, it doesn't deal with our modern scientific world and answer our scientific questions. In the ancient world, the big question on the table was the establishment of order in the cosmos. And of course, the ancient peoples had their own gods that they saw as establishing order. And Israel's got a different read on it. It's still very interested in the fact that Yahweh has established order for the cosmos, but it sees it a different way. The gods in the ancient world had ordered the world for themselves. God orders the cosmos because he intends to dwell among his people, and so it's ordered for us. In the ancient world, people are slaves. In the biblical idea, people are co-regents with God in his image, a partnership with him, and he wants to dwell among them. That's a very different picture, and it shows us the reason and the purpose for God's creation work. And I think we have to try to read it in that light instead of trying to turn it into a scientific treatise of some sort.
Right, and then we end up with a debate that the authors never intended, and certainly that God never intended in inspiring this. Again, it's not to say it's anti-scientific or unscientific, but it's written for different purposes. Tell you what, I've got one more question for you. I appreciate the generosity of your time. We could go on like this for years because there's so much to dig into. But when we come back, I just want to ask Professor Walton about the Book of Ruth and the Goel, the kinsman redeemer. What can we learn about that? How does that help us to better understand the Book of Ruth? So again, we're talking about the NIV Cultural Backgrounds Study Bible, now available. You can order it through our ministry. Not only will you help us with our radio broadcast, but we'll pay the postage and we'll give you free with it our two-hour interview with Professor Craig Keener on these very subjects in the New Testament. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It's been my delight to spend the last 45 minutes with Professor John Walton. He's professor of Old Testament at Wheaton and taught decades before that at Moody. And he is the co-editor of the NIV Cultural Backgrounds Study Bible, beautifully produced, replete with incredibly useful and rich background information. So, John, a lot of Christians know a little bit about the concept of kinsman redeemer, the Goel in ancient Israel, but obviously it's a theme of the Book of Ruth. What was this concept in the ancient world, and how does it help us better understand the Book of Ruth?
The role of the Goel could take on various shapes. It's used when someone or something is restored to a prior and really inherent normal status. In human terms, the family or clan is most often the active party in protecting that status. When Israel's the object, God can also function as the active party. This concept usually focuses on what someone or something is being restored from, but often it's more focused on what you're being restored to. So the Goel is trying to reestablish the rights of the family that Ruth and Naomi are part of, the clan of Elimelech, and it's trying to set those back. It's like a reset. It's kind of gone out of whack, and the Goel is trying to bring it back into balance. So that's really the Goel role as it exists in the clans and families of Israel.
Yeah, I love the way you've put it, reset and bringing things back to the way they're supposed to be. And then there's an ultimate image of that, isn't there, with the prophets to go back to kind of a peaceful, non-hostile, God-glorifying world that once existed but has now been lost, and that's kind of the dream of the prophets.
Well, the idea of restoring an equilibrium is certainly part of it. And for Israel, that kind of restoration is going to reset the covenant relationship the way it's supposed to be.
And your hope in producing this Bible, taking decades of study and now making it accessible to your average interested reader in Scripture, what's your hope and goal through this new Bible?
Well, certainly my hope is that people will be able to read God's Word more meaningfully. Too often we open the Bible and just read it casually, and the problem is that when we read it casually, we often are inadvertently imposing our filter, our cultural river, if you will. We're taking what is natural to us, but the fact is it's not natural to the ancient world. And if we really believe that the authority of the Bible is wound up in the author and what the author is saying, then we have to understand the context that he's speaking from. So my hope is that people will really be able to understand the Bible the way it was intended to be understood. I often make the statement, the Bible is written for us, but it's not written to us. And so we have to make the jump. The biblical author is not going to come to our cultural river. We have to go there, get the message, and then bring it back and apply it to our own times and our own lives. And I'm hoping this Bible will help people do that.
Excellent. Well, I believe you're going to see much fruit through your efforts, and really appreciate the many years of research and especially breaking it down in such a practical way. Thanks for joining us. Very much appreciate it, John.
You're very welcome.
All right. I've been speaking with Professor John Walton, the editor of the Old Testament portion of the NIV Cultural Background Study Bible. All right. Just as I say goodbye to John, there's a call from Susan in Marblehead, Massachusetts. But Susan, I am very much ready to answer your question head on because I've just finished work on a commentary on Job. So you've got a Job-related question. Go ahead, please.
I do. Thank you for taking my call, and thank your guest for being on. It was great to listen to him today as well. I'm just curious as to what your take is on the book of Job, whether you believe it that there was a real Job, or is it just a morality play, for lack of a better description for us.
Right. And this is actually a question that was debated even in the ancient rabbinic writings. Was Job just a parable or a myth, or did Job really exist? And then massive debate as to when he lived. Did he live in the days of the patriarchs? Did he live in the days of Mordecai and Esther? Did he live, you know, in the days of Moses? Just
right.
Massive speculation about that. We do have the reference to Job in the book of Ezekiel, and we have the reference to Job in the book of James, Jacob, pointing to him as being a real historical figure. But my understanding is this: it absolutely has to be based on historical truth. In other words, if it's just a story, then yeah, there are lessons you can learn from it, but Job is not an example to us. In other words, the example is the woman who overcame breast cancer and survived courageously and raised her family after her husband died in the war in Iraq. You know, you read her story and say that's a champion. Or
right.
This athlete who overcame adversity, you know, and now persevered and now became a world champion. If it's just, you know, Superman or Batman or, you know, whatever mythical figure, there's not the inspiration and lesson, nor does it speak to us in real life because we're dealing with real life issues. So,
right.
So someone who survives great hardship in a myth can't speak to me in the midst of hardship that I'm experiencing. That's just a story. That's just paper thin. So the best understanding of Job is this, from my viewpoint, and I would say most scholars, that there is a historical core. There was definitely a Job who was not an Israelite, probably pre-Israelite, could well be in the days of the patriarchs. And he did suffer terrible loss. And he was judged. He must have sinned. Something was wrong. And God does restore. And then what is now embellished for us is the poetic narrative, that there's no way that we think we have the original dialogue and that the friends all spoke in this very high-level intellectual poetry, chapter after chapter. Rather, the core of it is what happened, and now we have a literary enhancement of the dialogue inspired by the Lord, inspired through the author of Job. And probably the book of Job is not written until many centuries later. It could well be written around the time of the exile, immediately before or even during, with even potentially a message for the nation in that regard. But we have a good idea that it was written later, even though the style of the language is archaic, which could be done intentionally, just like if we wrote in older English today.
Right.
Job seems to make reference to other parts of the Bible, that the speakers are alluding to other passages of the Bible which were not written at that time.
Right.
So I absolutely see Job as a real historical figure and the account as reflecting historical reality, but then it is enhanced in a poetic dialogue by the inspired author. By the way, my commentary is going to be readable for the general public with many, many deep studies with it, but not out for another year or two. My bottom line today, come on, the Word is calling to you. Dig in and find hidden treasures.